Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, LA poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest, LA writer, art critic, and artist, Shayna Neese Dambrot. How are you, Shayna?
I'm well, Rich. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on the show. I'm very excited about today. Shayna Neese Dambrot is an art critic, curator, and author based in Los Angeles. She is currently the editor for White Hot Magazine, contributing editor for Art Limited, arts editor for Versus Magazine, and a contributor to the LA Weekly, Flaunt, Scene, and KCET's Artbound, formerly LA managing editor at flavorpill.com. Her other publications have included Modern Painters, Art Review, Art Week, Art News, The Believer, Tama Celeste, Angelino, Art Asia Pacific, Blue Canvas, Coagula, and Juxtapose. She studied art history at Vassar College, writes loads of essays for books and exhibition catalogs, curates one or two exhibitions each year, and speaks in public with alarming frequency. A full account of her activities is sometimes updated at sndx.net. Wow, Shayna, you're a busy woman.
I know, it's funny when I hear it all out loud like that. A lot of those magazines, of course, are these gorgeous print magazines that no longer exist. thank you, Changing World. But I like to keep it on there just to remind myself, that it's been a long time.
Yes, I know, and it's funny. Sometimes when I perform, and if someone reads my bio before I perform, I sometimes feel like, oh my God, now I have to live up to my bio. Jeez, but you've done a lot of great things. You know, since you're a writer, an artist, and art critic, I thought we'd mix things up a bit in our conversation and blur the lines a bit between art and writing and find out where these disciplines have particular converging points in your world. How's that sound?
A little scary, but fantastic.
Well, you know, you're a woman who lives up to a mighty impressive bio. So, you know, you've done a lot. I think you can handle this. I'm going to throw you a couple softballs first. Why don't you talk a little about the origins of your writing, your art, and art criticism?
Okay. Well, basically, I studied art history in college, and I kind of knew even before I did that what I wanted to do with my life, which is why I picked such a hefty art history program to go through. And that was because everyone in my family, like since I was 6 or 7, were placing bets on whether or not I would be a writer. Everybody sort of decided that. And the only question was, you know, what was that going to be? And I have written other kinds of things, you know, short fiction and, you know, poetry and things that no one's, you know, allowed to see. But the art critic thing came about because separately from that, what I loved to do, even as a young child, my favorite place in New York and New Haven, which are the two cities I mostly split my growing up in, was to haunt the art museums. And in New York, that was especially the Museum of Modern Art, where in New Haven, that was the Yale University Art Museum, as well as the sort of portrait, mini British kind of portrait gallery situation going on with their library. And, those were my areas of interest, and then writing was what I was good at. And at some point, I remember figuring out that, you know, you could conflate those two and that really was a job. you know, that you could have.
Right.
And that blew my mind. So I thought, oh, my gosh, you mean there's a thing I can do where people pay me to look at art and think about it and then write about it? That's crazy. And so as soon as I realized it was possible, I just became focused on creating that reality for myself. And it's funny about the art, because that's really new. And when I mean, when I say new, I mean it's now November 18th or something. September 13th was like the first time that I ever showed something I would consider to be my art. Not that I haven't done things that you could technically call making art, but it was never for anyone else or for any reason, like with very few exceptions. Maybe I printed something, you know, once for, you know, my boyfriend for Christmas. I mean, yeah, really nothing. But now I did it, and I've got the bug, and I'm going to have something in a local publication and something in another show in December, all photography. And so now I really, right now, like this moment, am starting to really sort of more thoroughly unpack the relationship between those things. Very much in progress, but I'm also aware that there is a deep relationship. So it's a kind of exciting time. I think you're the first person to call me an artist in public. So we'll just try that.
Well, you are.
Yeah. And you can have that
dubious
claim to fame if you want it.
Out of curiosity, the December show, which show are you going to be in December? You said photography.
Yes, well, it's a show that is called The Instagram Show, and I think the website is literally like theinstagramshow.com or something. And it's a local independent print lab, and it was a, kind of an open call for artists. And the truth is that I take all of my photographs with my iPhone, because it's handy and because I actually love a lot of these things that other people decry about, you know, the limitations of the technology. I appreciate them. And so it's all kind of right. And a friend of mine was organizing it, and I kind of cheated because I found out about it by getting the press release.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, you know, gosh darn it, I'm going to enter too. And so I'm going to have a piece in that.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because I have you to thank for this, actually, because if I hadn't seen your posting on Facebook, I would have totally missed it, because you made a posting, I believe, the day of the deadline.
It was like 10 at night, yeah.
Yeah, and you said, you know, that's how I roll or something like that. I'm you know, submitting. And I actually was like, oh, my God, I completely forgot about this Instagram show. So I promptly got online, submitted some photos, and I got two photos accepted into the show as well. So we're going to be in the same show together.
Oh, my gosh, that makes me so happy. I love knowing that.
So thank you.
Yeah, it's going to be great. You're welcome, and thank you. I think it's going to be – I know a few people who've done it, and it's not the usual suspects. You know, some people are – known photographers, some people like you and me went, hey, why not? But not to get off on a tangent right away, but that democratizing effect, although it can be a little bit problematic and it can result in kind of flooding the airwaves with randomness, I think also has had the desired effect of photography in the first place, which is to make it more possible for more people, regardless of their training and background, to interact with the visual world in a creative way. You know, I have talent as a photographer. I do not have talent as a painter. That's okay. But part of that is because it's a lot easier to learn what you can do and to work on your vision. You know, your creative vision, your framing, your instincts for a subject and composition and things like that, you know, with a camera in terms of just being a self-taught person. And I think a lot of people have discovered that they have a gift for something, and it's a lot easier to discover you have a gift for photography than to discover you have a gift for figure painting, you know, for example.
So
I kind of love that, and I'm looking forward to the show and to seeing what people are up to.
Absolutely.
And to see Instagram on paper, like to see the transference of this medium that's all about the 2x2-inch square to something that's an object in the world, I think is also going to be pretty fascinating. So I'm really looking at the eclecticism of it. So I think it's going to be pretty great.
Actually, a really good point. And that was actually one of the things that struck me as well. I'm really curious to see how they take these images, which are mostly associated with being online, and then you take them to the 3D image and, like you said, put them into the real world. It's going to be interesting how we sort of perceive them at that point, if they're going to take on a new life or something like that once they're brought into the, quote-unquote, you know, real world.
IRL, as the kids say, right? in real life.
Know, actually, to just touch upon something you were talking about before about your art and you sort of being new into, you know, kind of coming into the visual world, you know, the visual art world yourself, being a somewhat of a neophyte. I mean, because you've looked at art so much over the years and have, you know, sort of written so much art criticism, does that ever get in the way when you're creating your own art, or are you able to sort of put that aside and kind of, shall I say, create art like a child in a way that you're just able to kind of not put too much pretense or, you know, too many barriers between you and the work?
I would say it's both, in the sense that when I'm doing it, it's very much this kind of like slender kind of, oh my gosh, look at that, or there's a lot of architectural photography in it. There's a lot of, you know, that sort of noticing of, you know, a light pattern or a weird shadow that is cast, or something that's just an amazing color, or a situation that has a kind of inherent humor or juxtaposition, or, you know, something in it where you just walking down the street stop and go, oh my gosh, look at that. That will be the thing that I will want to take a picture of. And so in that sense, it's very much just an instinct, and it's just me kind of bouncing around. However, that said, I think in a sort of a Malcolm Gladwell sense of, you know, 10,000 hours, that instinct now has been very much informed and shaped by, you know, 30 years of trying to figure out what makes a picture good, which is kind of my job. So
right.
I just know I probably could, you know, sit down and break apart, you know, what these choices are. But I do know that the choice that I make, choices, at least not in the taking, at least in the sort of selecting, you know, of the one that is the one I want, where I'm going, no, make it a little off kilter, put that line this line up in a different way, get come in on it from a wackier angle, or try to, you know, or do something that really highlights the flattening out of, you know, the different perspectival planes. You know, I love how you can, you know, when it's a light like it is today, kind of bright but overcast, and you look at these, you know, sandstone buildings and this dark kind of, you know, 100-year-old concrete and this patinated metal on these buildings, and then the sky is kind of like the same color as that, right? So you take a picture, and in the camera it looks really flat and really surreal and really almost fake. But you know you're looking right at it, and that it's really, you know, and that kind of moment where the camera really does something, and so you know you're looking at a picture and not the real thing, and, you know, all those things that I like when I'm looking at other people's art, I hope that
right.
I can at least identify that those are the choices I'm trying to make when I'm putting something out there as my own, not specific other people that I'm channeling. I think as I've started taking pictures, I think there's something that you could really, or one or two things that you could identify as my personal, you know, sort of taste, but then they mirror the things that I find myself drawn to in my career as an analyst of art. So it's, on the one hand, it's a very separate thing to do with my brain, but on the other hand, there's no doubt that it exists on a continuum.
Right, right. So you've had to, you know, over the years, you've seen tons and tons of art, I'm sure. You've had to write about art that I'm sure you were crazy about, you adored, and I'm sure you've had to write about art that you weren't so crazy about, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But what type of art, whether it's photography, painting, whatever, what type of art really speaks to you?
It's such a snarky thing to be like, good art, Rich. I like good art.
But I'm bummed.
Right? But I'm bummed. The New Yorker art critic, Peter Sheldahl, I did a workshop with him many years ago at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and he said something that, when he said it, really resonated with me, and I felt legitimately that although he said it, it really articulated something I'd been kind of looking at myself, and that is to this question of, you know, what's art? And he talked about it in terms of intention and resolution. So what he actually said was, he asks himself, does the artist know what I'm looking at? Right? Does the artist know what I'm looking at? I know, goosebumps. So, and what he meant by that, or at least what I took it to mean and have been working with, is that the artist has a skill set that includes a marginally objective ability to evaluate the finished product. Because you just know, you walk into like a yard sale or something, right? And there's some terrible painting and the ocean's purple and there's some sailboat and it's like not even, you know, like think of just like really something that would be universally bad beyond questions of taste, right? But you know that the artist who did that didn't think, wow, that's a crappy painting. They were super excited about it. Probably because there was something in it that they saw, that they knew that it represented, that they were exploring. That was important to them, and in that hermetic vision, they kind of got there. They did it. Because for them, it's not about art critics and galleries or whatever. You know, it's not about any of us, and that's fine. My God, do that, everyone. Make that game, you know, please. Part of life, then, you know, you get to the point where you're putting it in a gallery and it's a public thing and blah, blah. And I feel so often that that ability for the artists themselves to really thoroughly communicate, you know, like they have a responsibility to their own ideas, to communicate them as efficiently or at least as thoroughly or, you know, effectively as possible. No matter what it looks like and no matter what they're working with, even if ambiguity is important to them, you know, there could be room for that. It doesn't, you know, have to be, you know, like a slogan or something. But, you know, there's a quality of completeness and a kind of gestalt, like a wholeness that a good work of art has. And then you can, after that, get into questions of appreciation. Do I personally love this? Maybe not. But do I feel confident that I know what the artist was going for? Yes or no. Mm-hmm. And then I can decide if I'm on board with what they were going for or not or whatever and do the critic thing. But first, I think it's their job to get to where they don't have to be standing there explaining their work to me for me to understand it. That's on them. And so I kind of start with that, and then I move forward. For example, I do not love Impressionism. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I don't care about it. I don't rush out to see it. By the same token, I so appreciate what Impressionism did, what it accomplished in art history. I completely understand what the artists were after, and I think they got there in a way that changed the visual world forever. You know, and even set off, you know, trends in like neuroscience and, you know, writing and like all kinds of things. And I so get that. But I don't love to look at it. That does not mean I would say it's bad art. It's some of the best art by what I just said ever made, which is different than whether I personally love it. So I do try to keep those things as separate as I can, you know, not clinically, but at least, you know, that's what my open-mindedness looks like, is trying to do that first before I go straight to, you know, myself.
Yeah. So, you know, you've, and kind of still touching upon the same subject, but, you know, kind of looking at it a different way, I'm sure you've gotten called to write about in certain, you know, pieces of art or artists that don't really excite you. And so this is kind of a two-part question. One, how do you go about, when you write about something, how do you go about making the unexciting exciting? And also, how do you go about writing about a form of art, let's say painting, for instance, or photography, where that art form is mostly known because of its visual form? How do you put that sort of thing into words?
That's a really interesting, I mean, well, that's, you know, that's the secret sauce, right? I mean, that's, you know, not to, I'm not trying to be like, because I'm magic, Rich. But I mean, I do think, I do think that what you're saying, like, really touches on something that's, you know, part of who I am, which is a whole other thing having to do with, you know, the way I was, you know, who my parents were and what they're about and just, like, how my mind is and what I'd be doing if I wasn't doing this and all that stuff, which is that I think that when I am doing my best work, I'm furthering the cause of people understanding the art in question, and maybe, you know, art in general, you know, overall. But, you know, piece by piece or, you know, show by show, whatever, talk article by article, you know, I am sort of doing my version of what the artist did before me, which is to say, you know, an interpretation, maybe the providing of an entry point or two into the work, making it easier for the people who read what I have to say to enter the conversation, to engage with the art, a few things they might want to keep in mind while they're doing that. If I don't like the work, that might include an evaluation of why I don't think the artist did a particularly good job, but that doesn't mean it isn't worth talking about. So it's the same kind of dynamic. In terms of, like, when I'm asked to do, like, a catalog essay or something, where it's different than magazine work because I'm writing, you know, sort of on the artist's behalf, and it's a proponent position when you're doing a catalog essay as opposed to, say, an exhibition review or something. What I try to do is ferret out as much as I can about what they are trying to do, and then I compare that to the work that I see, and I pull the things out of the work that I see that best match what they're saying they're after. So, right, you know, I help them to create that moment where the audience is capable to apprehend in as much completeness as possible what the point of the work and the message of the work, you know, is. Because I'm sort of, it's almost more of a collaboration at that point. Not as an exercise, we're not writing together, but we're on the same idea train together, as opposed to the role of a critic, which is nominally more separate, and it's more of a discourse, and it's a response, a back and forth. It doesn't have to be definitive. You know, it can go on over years. It's a shorter length usually, you know. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic between those two kinds of writing. I almost never write about art that I don't like for magazines, and I certainly never do it for an essay. There has to be something there that I respond to that I can feel, you know, I'm proud about having my name, you know, be on the side of supporting it. So I keep an eye on that. But I get very lucky. I've never really had to say no most of the time. By the time someone comes to me, I've written about their work before, I've been recommended, someone's put it together. There's, you know, there's already some kind of rapport. I've never, thank God, knock wood, right? But I've never had to go, wow, you're great, but I'm so busy. I've never had to do that. I've been very, very fortunate. I like to think I would make the right choice no matter what my bank balance looks like. But as I've said, I'm very grateful that I've not had to. So.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure you've seen this a lot over the years, both good and bad. And this I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on. How does press affect how people perceive art and artists?
Wow. In a way, I wish I knew, you know, but in a way, I mean, I can say I don't count, right? Like, take me out of how it affects me, obviously, because, you know, like, it's, you know, doctors read the Journal of the American Medical
right.
Association or whatever, right? It's trade publications for us. Out there in the world, like collectors and stuff, I don't think that it makes the same immediate one-to-one impact that you could argue it maybe made, you know, back in the day, whatever the day was. I think that there's some level at which people do and don't read. So they care about the newspapers and the magazines, but it's like a Warhol thing where you weigh your press instead of reading it. You know, so I don't think artists that, or collectors or dealers truly say, respond to exactly what the critic has to say in terms of, like, shaping what they're doing. But I do think that there is a sort of aggregate benefit to being covered as an artist or as a gallery, even if it's not that every single notice is glowing, but that, you know, that's an acknowledgement that you're in the talk. You have a seat at the table. People are looking at what you're doing. Not everyone's going to love it, but they're going to say it's important enough to talk about, even if they don't love it, and to think about and to compare. And it's similar to being chosen, you know, for a higher profile exhibition. You know, like, you're in there, like, your name's in the record now. You know, you're part of what you know, is happening. You're documented. And I think that to that extent, it's still very important to people. And some galleries will tell you that it translates into sales. I obviously don't know that to be true one way or the other, although I can imagine a world in which a younger or a mid-level collector might be on the fence about something, and then they see that the artist has gotten an amazing review from a well-known writer, and they think, you know what, I'm going to do it. It's not just me. I'm not the only one that loves these. Look, Art Forum loves these. Look, Jana Jambrot loves these. Or somebody put it in the, you know, in the weekly, and so now I know the opening, and I'm going to meet the artist, and maybe that's going to make a difference. And so I think there is absolutely a contribution, but I would not say that it is, the thunderbolt from Mount Olympus that maybe, you
right.
know, Greenberg achieved with Pollock or something. But I think that's more of a function of the culture and the media landscape than anything else. So, but I feel very much in the game. I know people read what I write. I know the artists read it. I know the dealers read it. I know collectors and just, you know, random, the general pop art appreciating populace reads it. And not only me, but, you know, all of my colleagues. And for that, you know, I'm very amazed and grateful always. So I don't feel like it's a vacuum. I feel like it's very much a part of the landscape, but I wouldn't be
right.
circumspect in describing its actual power, air quotes,
yeah.
power.
Do you, something you just said kind of made me think of this question. Do you get hit upon by a lot of artists? Do you have a lot of people, like, sort of knocking on your door and saying, you know, Shayna, write about my art, write about me, write about this, write about that?
Yeah, I don't want to sound, you know, like one of those people, like Chris Christie, right? Like, stop asking me if I want to be president. I mean, I love that, you know, there's an interest, right? Yeah, this makes
right.
me happy. I have an ego. This is my
yeah.
career. I want people to want a piece of me, right? That's what you want. But then
sure.
at a certain point, it's like, you know, I'll write an article and I'll put it on Facebook and half the comments will be, you should write about me, da-da-da. And it's like, you are about to get unfriended, because can I just have 2 minutes where first you read what I actually did and then
right.
something, something. But on the other hand, of course, the alternative is impossible to contemplate. I don't want to be ignored, and I appreciate the competitiveness and, you know, the hustle that goes into being an artist, which, by the way, not to accidentally circle full time back to the front. But I personally do not have the temperament to be a full-time artist. The ability to persevere in your vision when people are telling you no all day, every day, for months or weeks or years, is so unimaginably brave and courageous to me that
I agree.
That I know for a fact I could no sooner do that than decide to go try to be an actress. That level of rejection, regards that has so little to do with talent so often, is it's just, you know, the numbers game aspects of it with, you know, 20,000 artists and 400 galleries, you know, doing 10 shows a year. It's like it almost doesn't matter how good you are, right? So I don't begrudge them the hustle. I don't.
Yeah.
It gets a little bit much for me, and I don't go to openings a lot because of it. I tend to go see art in the middle of the week, in the middle of the day, when I can look at it, unless it's like a dear friend or something, because it's a little intense for me. And not just me, by the way. A lot of people in my position, I mean, you know, a rock critic, you know, going to shows. And I mean, it's not me. I'm not special. This is just like what happens, you know. So does it irritate me on a daily basis? Sure. But do I actually have a problem with people doing it? Not really. I kind of get it. I get it. And what they're doing is crazy, right? So they've got to do it. They have to make sure people know, and it's on them. You know, I work for publications, so they do the heavy lifting of readership and distribution, and I just, you know, put my stuff in there. So to have to do all that yourself is such a heavy lift. I don't blame people for asking for help. You know, I would imagine I would be the same, or I wouldn't, which would be my problem.
Yeah. Sticking on the idea of writing for a moment, and I've asked you this before, and I'm hoping you're going to tell a particular story, because when you told me this story, I just loved it. So if you feel comfortable, I would love you to retell it. I once asked you the question about if you ever felt that you were sort of in over your head with a particular writing project, and you went on to tell me a story about Tobey Maguire. I was wondering if you feel okay with retelling that story.
I think that was after a couple of those snake's blood cocktails, if I recall. Well, I'll tell you, I mean, look, Tobey Maguire can take it. And Tobey, if you're listening, I love you. I think you're a talented and intelligent and compassionate human, and I swear to God, I am your fan, Mr. Tobey Maguire. And he gave me a fantastic, we love you, Tobey. And he gave me a fantastic interview for Versus magazine, which, by the way, I feel compelled to say is spelled VS, but in fact pronounced Versus as it is in English, although that can be a little problematic when you're trying to tell someone the magazine and they don't have a visual because they're looking for the word Versus, but it's spelled BS. So, okay, anyway, that magazine, which is a fashion and culture magazine based in New York and Amsterdam that I write about art for every issue, which is only twice a year, but there we are. And I'm sort of like their de facto LA person because although I'm their art person, I'm the only one that lives here as well. So I have over the years interviewed people that are not my comfort zone for the magazine. I interviewed the Marciano, the head of Guess, right? Like, I know anything about the history of fashion, you know what I mean, for the same magazine. And one day they tell me I'm going to interview Tobey Maguire. And I'm thinking, okay, great. I love Tobey Maguire, which I do. However, when I said to myself at that moment I love Tobey Maguire, unbeknownst to myself, what I was really saying was, I love Elijah Wood. So I proceed to be like all excited, and I'm like, oh my God, I love the ice storm, Elijah Wood. Oh my God, I know Vigo a little bit. I've written about him as an artist, so we could totally talk about, like, you know, if they were taking pictures on Lord of the Rings or whatever, Elijah Wood.
Elijah Wood.
Yeah. So, okay, well, there's that really killer TV show that's really crazy and funny about the guy who's, like, thinks that his neighbor's dog can talk to him? Elijah Wood.
Elijah
and
Wood.
Now it's like,
sorry, Toby.
Elijah Wood. Yeah.
We're like now, Elijah Wood 4,
oh my God.
Toby 0.
So bad. So then I'm like, oh, my fucking God, right? Like, what have I done? Well, I can't. And I'm like, okay, well, I actually kind of dug how, like, dark and weird the Spider-Mans were. Well, you can't talk about Spider-Man because they just did a reboot of the franchise because they thought he was too old to play Peter Parker anymore. So you can't talk about Spider-Man. Okay.
Sorry, Toby.
Well, The Great Gatsby is coming out in December, and that's supposed to be fantastic. Why don't you talk to him about that? Okay. So so basically, to prepare for the Tobey Maguire interview, I ended up watching Cider House Rules and rereading The Great Gatsby the night before. And that was, like, what I went in there with because that's what I had. And then I walk into the office, and I'm thinking, I am so fired, right? But I get in there, and the whole office is full of the most amazing modern and contemporary art collection, fantastic young painters. He's sitting underneath this great Ed Ruscha is a word piece, and one of, you know, obviously, but I mean, it was like a cloud blue sky background with a few words on it. One of the words, I think, is Mountain, and that is the name of his production company. So he has that in his office. And then he starts telling me about the work he wants to do with the Education Council at LACMA and how the production company is working with Mocha TV on the stuff that they're doing. And it was like, thank God, you know, art saves my life, you know, again. And we ended up talking about that for most of the time. That led into stories about his childhood and what his motivations were for loving art and education. And he pulls his first edition of The Great Gatsby off the shelf, and we start talking about the movie because of the book. And, I mean, and it ended up being, like, this total miracle. And the piece turned out great. And I never told him that story because I kind of thought he wouldn't think it was as funny as I did. But, that was the deal. And so, you know, I've had kind of miracles like that a few times along the way, but I do agree that one kind of takes the cake.
Yeah. Well, actually, Toby, I mean, I love Tobey Maguire. He's been in some great movies. I mean, Pleasantville, which was a movie that I loved. And,
oh, my God, I totally saw that. I loved that movie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He was also
was
a hit.
Like,
I'm on Tobey Maguire's IMDb page right now. He was a hitchhiker in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And
I saw both those movies. See, I should have called you.
He was in The Ice Storm. And
Elijah
yeah.
Wood was also in The Ice Storm, right?
What's that?
Or was that Tobey Maguire? Was Elijah Wood
no,
in the
Tobey
Ice Storm
Maguire
too?
No, actually was in the Ice Storm. I think that one should one actually should Toby.
Oh my God, I got bad information. My friends are losers.
Yeah, Toby was in the Ice Storm. That's
Emily,
funny.
I knew it.
Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Maybe she's a Toby hater or something. Damn you, Emily. So, Shayna, besides yourself,
yes.
Who are some of the tastemakers in the, I'm going to say the global art scene, and how do these tastemakers go about affecting who and what becomes popular and doesn't become popular in the art world?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that, you know, is, as the kids used to say, the $64,000 question.
Right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, nobody really sort of knows because it's so cumbersome, you know, and unmanageable. I do think, though, that one thing that has happened, and I hope this kind of answers your question, but one thing that has happened is, and I kind of feel not like responsible, like I did that, although I do kind of think that in L.A. I helped do it a little, is to kind of mainstream art into the rest of the sort of culture media, right? So, for example, I write for more than one magazine that is not in any way an art magazine. But no one in their right minds anymore would start a magazine that doesn't have art in it. That was not right. always the case, right? So even People Magazine writes about art on a truly regular basis. Not maybe they don't have like an art editor, but, you know, they do it. So it's become part of the fabric of daily existence in a way that makes me very, very happy. And one thing, and the part of the reason that even though I quit 3 years ago, I keep the LA Flavor Pill on my, you know, in the forefront of my bio is because I'm very proud of what we accomplished when I ran the LA edition for, you know, 7 or 8 years or something. But one of the reasons that I loved working there is because they were launching an events-based city guide where they wanted hand-picked, independent things to go and do and see. And they weren't afraid to put an art critic in charge of that, right? I wasn't an events editor. I wasn't a calendar editor. I was an art critic. But they thought, well, writing about art is good. I mean, you know, it's like they were so on that forefront of having art be integrated into the popular culture discourse on a more thorough manner, where it's not just once in a while, but it's right up there with music and style and sports and movies and art and food. Boom, all equal, right? Not just a niche thing that, like, some fancy people care about, but, like, something any given human might do with their Friday or Saturday or Thursday night, right? And yep. museums, too. You know, go. You know, I remember writing about the Van Gogh show for Juxtapose magazine in 1998 or something at LACMA, and people were like, Juxtapose is about hot rod monster art. And I was like, you want monster art? Go look at these paintings Van Gogh did in 1888. Like, that was some dark shit. Yeah. You know, like, you know, don't fool yourself. Absinthe drinker, this is not for your coffee mug. Like, this is heavy. Like, you're going to find something for you, for yourself there. I promise. I mean, right? It's like, look, people who like Robert Williams, it's like, you may not think so, but, you know, go check it out. And I realized half an hour ago I said I don't like Impressionism, but I am, in my own defense, speaking about his earlier, darker work, and even his later work never really got lighthearted. But, you know, that right. kind of thing, right? And so Flavor Pill let me put as much art as indie music. So it'd be like the Echoplex and the New Image Art Gallery and the Rock, Paper, Scissors, Rumble, you know, and it was equal. And I loved that, and people responded to that. And the gallery and museum community embraced the idea of an internet-based events magazine with real writing, you know, hand-picked things, 10 things a week, you know, 200-word listings by fans and people who knew what they were talking about as the writers. And at that time, that was very, very new. You know, I feel like I'm describing, like, the invention of, you know, a motorized carriage or something. And this was, like, you know, 11 years ago. But it really was a new thing. And right. To me, that visionary understanding that art, and then very quickly soon thereafter books as well, became integral and sort of reclaimed by indie culture as being something worth doing, you know. And I think after that, it's partly due to everything being digital and so visual now. Well, artists are, like, ready for you. Right? You want a visual-based pop culture? You know, we're making pictures all day long already. So I think yeah. that in a way, artists were always poised to benefit from the shift to a more trans-global, image-based media than anyone. And I think that's, yeah. You know, I wish I could have articulated it that perfectly. Like, the day I got the job, you know, it took me a while to figure it out. But I now have come to see that I really do think that's the deal, because the proliferation yeah. of great things like the Very Short List and Lost at E Minor, and remember, you know, Daily Candy for a minute back in the day, and Flavor, those things, you know, were among the earliest to really seize on that. And that they had it all over print, in the fact that they could include 15 images, in, you know, as big as they wanted, with a given article instead of one, two, you know, 3x3 inch, maybe black and white picture, you know, with a review, they could put, you know, now they're putting a virtual tour of the entire exhibition. They're putting videos. They're putting, and, you know, from an art critic, art media point of view, that's amazing. You know, that is, like, amazing, right? That's all you ever wanted, was to be able to put more images with your coverage. And I think that that, in turn, has helped bring more audiences because they're looking right at it, you know, bam. And I think, you know, that's only good.
Cool. Kind of to sort of cross with this idea of painting and writing and writing and painters, who would you consider to be some painterly writers?
Ooh, curveball. Oh my gosh. I mean, I could take that, like, from so many, you know, aspects. I mean, last year I finally got around to reading Black Swan Green by David Mitchell, and there were like a week where I just thought, fuck it, I'm never reading another novel. Like, that's it. Like, that was the best. Like, you just, there's no point. Like, everybody, pencils down. Like, just find something else to do. It's like somebody wrote this book already. You know, it's that good. And part of it was, you know, that his amazing gift. You know, to just kind of seamlessly draw you into the world. You know, there's dialect, but it's not distracting. It's a time and place, but it's universal. You know, it's the new Catcher in the Rye, they're saying, you know, that may or may not be true. I didn't cry at the end of Catcher in the Rye, and I probably, J.D. Salinger would smack me in the head if I cried, right? But this book, anyway, so as far as novels go, but I mean, I read Gertrude Stein too, because that same kind of Joycean sing-song, like, don't worry too much about the grammar, just, like, you know, get in the raft and just, like, go with it. You know, I love that. As far as art, people who write about art, I would say Simon Sharma is kind of who I want to be when I grow up. He's an English scholar who has a series that many people might remember from PBS called The Power of Art. And he does stuff like walk to where J.M.W. Turner painted the painting of the harbor so that you can really understand that, as strange as the painting may have looked to people, that was also what, you know, that particular day, you know, of the coast of England, you know, looked like. And so there, you know, to help you really, like, to bring you, like, right into the world. And he has a way of mixing a kind of poetic language and with a kind of brusqueness where it's very warm and very compassionate and very evocative, and it's very accessible language. It's not, you know, highfalutin exclusionary art speak, although it's not, you know, it's smart, you know, it's for smart people, but you don't need a degree, you know, it's public television, right? It's like, it's that kind of at its best. And then, you know, where he takes art history, things that you might be forgiven for thinking are, you know, old stuff in the past, you know, dry, and making it really live. And he speaks about contemporary art as well. And so someone like him, is really, that's kind of what I aspire to. You know, I want it to be accessible without being diluted. And that's kind of a hard needle to thread. You know, it's not about me proving I'm smart. You know, it's like, you can know where I went to school and that I did well there. So you can probably figure out that, you know, I've read a lot of books and I know a lot of really big fancy words and I scored really well on my SAT. But that's not what I'm writing to prove, you know, now. I want to make people care about the things I care about. Just like, you know, you could probably get that answer from Jonathan Gold. You know, it's like, he cares about food, and he wants you to care about it too, and that really is
Pulitzer Prize doing so.
Well,
bless his
and
heart.
That was life changing because I have now decided that it's okay to want a Pulitzer Prize because he's like the first real critic, you know, the first food critic, I think, you know, to get one. And I think if you don't, I would have to look up, you know, the Roger Ebert situation. But except for him, critics don't win. Pulitzer Prizes.
Right.
And the fact that that is, has changed, I think sort of retroactively validates, you know, the idea of criticism, you know, as being important on a journalistic continuum as well as on a, you know, a prose skill continuum. So that's the kind of, those are the kind of things that I'm interested in. I love Michael Kimmelman and the New York Times because although I think Roberta Smith is maybe the greatest writer of that I'm going to, you know, have lived contemporaneously with in my field, I think she has a magneticism that has accomplished the same things that I'm accomplishing. I think it, her prose can be a little sharp for me to personally enjoy reading it sometimes, but I think her taste is spot on and her ability to generate interest in the broader population is laudable. I think she deserves her success, and I'm a fan. You know, but as far as writing, it's all about Simon Schama and her colleague Michael Kimmelman for the simple point that he's the first sort of modern day, you know, postmodern, the age we live in now, post-cynicism kind of writer to really say things like, this is beautiful. Seeing it is an ecstatic experience. You know, that kind of thing. People don't say that stuff anymore. You know, it doesn't make them sound smart enough to just say something beautiful, right? But sometimes it is. And it's weird that it would take a little balls to say something beautiful, right? But in my weird world, that was like a no-no for a hot minute. And that never sat right with me. And so that's part of the reason I live in L.A. and not New York, and that's part of the reason that I love Michael Kimmelman at the New York Times because, you know, he's, like, really swimming with the sharks over there, and he's holding it down for, you know, romance with a capital R. So those are people that mean a lot to me.
Nice. You have many interesting friends, many very talented friends, and one of them, Brandon Boyd, lead singer of Incubus. You two recently worked together. I was wondering if you could tell the listeners about that project.
Yeah, I'd love to. He is an amazing soul. And, you know, it's funny, and I think I've kind of told him this, like, kind of in joking. It's like, I don't listen to Incubus. Right? Like, no offense, but, you know, I'm a way more of, like, a Leonard Cohen kind of girl.
You know what I mean?
Wire movies. I know what the hell is wrong with me. Well, apparently, we've just discovered I do watch Tobey Maguire movies.
Yes, you do.
That I didn't even know. But Brandon, is, and personally, a very well-rounded, very spiritual human who has just released a solo album. And that matters because that is tied sort of existentially and temperamentally to his decision to release a book of his art, which he had done before, but not in this kind of, like, formal format, you know, where, you know, he had exhibited drawings and paintings. He'd done work with Tom's Shoes and a museum in Monterey and other things in Europe and galleries in Hollywood. I mean, it was known that he made visual art. He was very good at it, and the work was very popular. And he had done, you know, books of his drawings and sort of reproducing some of his sketchbooks that he takes on tour and things like that before. So it wasn't like out of nowhere. But this is like a fancy, heavy, vellum-covered, hardcover, you know, art book, right? And I wrote the introductory essay for it. And the work that he does is very intuitive and very, you know, this is another word, like beautiful, but very spiritual and very, I think I said intuitive, but what I really mean by that is what he does is he sort of makes these kind of like ink spillages, these clouds with like ink and watercolor. You know, that create, you know, these kind of abstract color fields. And then he goes into this kind of like semi-trance-like state and starts pulling imagery out of it, abstract or figurative. Sometimes it's more like a symbol or something. And it has this very Jungian mandala-like quality to it. And it's very affecting emotionally and very beautiful, or at least in the cases when it's a little bit more unsettling, it's very intricate and sort of magical is a hinky word, but I mean, it's the kind of thing where you look at it and it kind of blows your mind, you know. And so he wanted some help kind of explaining it, because he's a smart guy, but from his point of view, it was just what he does, you know. And it was kind of a beautiful moment, because not only was it a great job for me, which I very much enjoyed, both the work and Brandon, but also because he was using my writing as a way of understanding what he had done himself also. Yeah. Like he was like, basically like, I can't wait to find out what my work means. You know, right? I know. I love him. And that's
any listeners out there, if you're questioning your life in any way, you know, call upon Shayna, have her hang out with you a bit, and then she can write about you and help you understand your life better.
Well, you know, it's funny, but a little while ago I made a sort of like throwaway reference to what I'd be doing if I weren't doing this, and the absolute 100% truth is that I would be a psychoanalyst. I would be a psychoanalyst if I were an art critic. And I think your listeners right now are having that moment where they already know what I'm about to say. It's basically the same job.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm
You're
looking
right about
at your art, and I'm trying to reverse engineer your motivation, and I'm trying to figure out how much of it is really you versus how much is external. And I'm trying to see how, you know, the relationship between emotion and history and narrative, and, you know, it really is like 98% overlap. You know, I would have had to go to a different school maybe, but I really feel like how I would spend my day would be exceptionally similar if I were a psychoanalyst than an art critic. And so there really is kind of a lot of that in me already. And so when Brandon said that, and then when I realized I was actually going to be kind of writing a little bit about Carl Jung as part of it, you know, the whole thing kind of went, you know, kind of snapped into place a little bit. It was a very bright moment. So
nice. So we're getting
the book is now
very
available
close.
On Amazon.
Yes. It's available on Amazon. Yes. There's a plug there. Go Brandon. Go Shayna.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to the end of our time, Shayna, but I have one final question. I mean, heck, I could spend days and days with you, but I have one final question for you. And what do you consider to be some of the must-see art people must experience before they die?
Oh my God. I don't know. As much as possible. Holy shit. Toby Maguire movie. Well, I will say that Kazimir Malevich changed my life. And these are the suprematist paintings from like 1917 to, you know, the early 30s or late 20s. The Russian avant-garde, which, you know, look, sounds old-fashioned, but I, in the current On Stands Now issue of Fancy Pants Flaunt magazine, have an article that's about the Russian avant-garde that's keyed to an exhibition of Kazimir Malevich's work that's opening in Amsterdam. So it may be 100 years old, but it's, you know, it has this survival. But I think that basically, you know, there are obviously, I'm not going to bother reiterating the sort of like, you know, the great art of the world, you know, I mean, go to the Louvre, go to the Tate, go to the Prado. I mean, you know, go to those places that are like, you know, the wonders of the world. Definitely, you know, do that. But I would also say that in terms of the art people have to see, you know, before they die, I would say that, you know, seeing those things can be a little bit tricky, you know, travel. Not everyone can just, you know, go to Istanbul because someone said there was a great, you know, sculpture in a certain plaza, right? But I would say truly, and not even to be a cop-out about it, to really just see as much as possible. To wherever you live, there's a proliferation of regional museums now. There's been an amazing uptick in, you know, small colleges and, you know, not just the huge megalopolis locations for wonderful sort of public, you know, art collections. And you know, Kansas City has several incredible museums. It's like really just, you know, anyone that can hear my voice, there is new art and maybe even old art near you worth seeing, I swear to God. No matter where you live, you're like maybe 10 miles at the most from something, you know, worth taking off the afternoon to go check out. And even if it just means looking at the paintings that are on the cafe windows in the random truck stop of a town that you live in, you don't know if you're going to love them. So look at the walls, you know, just do it, right? Wayne White started out selling his paintings for $600 at Fred 62. And, you know, he's now one of the greatest, you know, acknowledged living artists in America. And, you know, that sometimes is just what happens. So you never, ever know, and you should look at everything.
Nice. And on that profound note, with me today has been Shayna Neese. With me today has been Shayna Neese Dambrot, art critic, curator, and author based here in Los Angeles. Shayna, where can people find out? I mentioned earlier in your bio, sndx.net, that you sometimes update. Where are some other places where people can find out about more about you and the work you do online?
I would say this. I am not like, I feel like I work for Facebook or anything, but they do make it easy to proliferate and disseminate. However, you know, Twitter also, if you're anti-Facebook, I completely understand your point of view. And maybe Twitter is a little less intensive. And it's just my first and middle name, Shayna Neese, S-H-A-N-A-N-Y-S. And I tend to post at least once everything that I write about to both Facebook and Twitter so that, you know, there's sort of a living archive because much of what I do happens, you know, before it happens, you know, it's an event preview or recommendation or it's something that is still up where maybe I update my website twice a year or something. So, you know, if you want to be more current and maybe be able to catch some things I've written about, social media, for better or worse, really is the best way for now.
Nice. Nice. Shayna, thank you so what a pleasure this has been. Thank you so, so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for even thinking to have me. I'm really, really honored, and I loved this. I could do this all day with
Good.
You. And you know,
Yay.
I'm your biggest fan too, Rich Ferguson. Let's get that in.
Well, thank you. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. And after that long-winded rant, all that's left to say is I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.
I'm no longer blind.